what about your first job, Mum?
First job, okay. Well, I left school at 15 with a very unimpressive leaving certificate. So the field of commerce and industry wasn't really jumping up and down to get me. So I started work in a shipping office. My first job was in a shipping office. And my job entailed making cups of tea for the shipping clerks and answering the phone and generally just doing the kind of odd jobs around the office. I was taken on as a junior clerkess, but I can't really remember getting too much clerkess work to do. But I quite enjoyed it. But my main job and the most important job of the whole place seemed to be me cleaning out and lighting the fires in the various offices. There was three offices. There was the big main office and where everybody really congregated, the shipping clerks and the administrative staff. There was the office for Mr. Kinnis, who was the owner of the company, and his son Barry, who would take over the company. And they were a very, very nice pair, these people, very nice people. And the third office was the office for the secretary. She had an office of her own, and each of them, believe it or not, had a fireplace with a fire in it. And each of these fires every day had to be cleaned out, reset and lit for the people coming in. So I had to be in my work at 8:30, and I would then start to clean out the fire, because at night we would just let the fire burn out. Wasn't allowed to keep it on overnight because of, well, they wanted to save the fuel. So we would let the fire burn out, and in the morning I would clean out the three fires, set them and light them. And that was okay, but one of the biggest problems was that we were two flights up in this very, very old-fashioned tenement down at the docks with huge stairs, huge banisters. It was a really big, kind of a big, bulky sort of place. That's the only way I could describe it. And the coal was kept in the cellar, which was in the basement, and the basement had no lights. And, you know, it didn't catch any of the daylight. So I had to really go down there in the dark of the morning. It didn't matter when you went down, it was still dark, down in the basement, and fill the coal scuttles. There was a coal scuttle for each office. And it was not sensible, but what I used to do was fill the coal scuttle. And I'd fill this up, and then I would bump it virtually with my knee from step to step to step, because I couldn't actually lift it. It never ever occurred to me to only half fill the scuttle, and it would be so much easier. No. The coal scuttle was filled to overflowing, because my idea was it would save me coming back down again during that day. And I would do that, and of course the coal scuttles were very heavy. So one day, Mr. Kinnis, we used to call him old Mr. Kinnis, as opposed to young Mr. Kinnis, old Mr. Kinnis was coming up the stairs this morning, and he said, he could hear the bump, 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 you know, the thud of the scuttle being bumped up. And he said to me, "Audrey, what on earth are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm bringing up the coal for the fires." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, you know, the fires run on coal." And he said, no, "Why are you bringing up the coal?" And I said, "Well, that's part of my job, to bring up the coal." And he said, "Nonsense. What a lot of nonsense." He said, "We have four big, strong shipping clerks that work here, and one of them could be delegated each day to bring up the coal. You will no longer be bringing up the coal." And I was so happy, really. They weren't. The shipping clerks weren't happy. And another, well, that was the end of me bringing up the coal. But one of the big problems I had was I could never get the fires to light. I wasn't good at lighting fires, because at home, Olive, you know, would always light the fire. I was never allowed to light the fire, being the younger one. So I had the most awful job. And then my mum bought me the big saviour of all time was a packet of fire lighters. She bought me a packet of fire lighters, and I would stick a couple on the sticks. I think the sticks were sometimes damp for lighting the fire. Put them in, light it, and woof, away it would go. Because the shipping clerks were down on the docks early in the morning, sometimes at 7 o'clock, for the ships coming in to take, you know, there was a thing called a bill of lading, and the shipping clerks used to take a note of the, what was coming in off the ships. So they were down in the cold mornings, down and standing on the docks, and the one thing that all that asked was that the kettle was on, the cups were out, the coffee was there, the sugar was there, the milk was there, a few rich tea biscuits, but the most important thing of all was the big blazing fire. And to be more than honest, they very, very seldom had a big blazing fire when they came in, because I could never get the fire to light. But practice makes perfect. And about 6 months down the road, they got the blazing fire. And certainly after they were bringing up the coal, they had a blazing fire on. So that was my first job. I stayed there till I was... I was 15 when I went there. I stayed there till I was 16 and a half. And then I began to get a wee bit ambitious. I thought, I mean, really, I could be doing more than lighting fires and making cups of tea. And I saw an advert in the courier office, newspaper office, for a junior typist. Now, that was a wee step up from a junior clerkess, because you would get to do some typing. So I went for the interview, and I was quite shocked to get the job, really, because I wasn't a great typist, you know, and I hadn't had a lot of experience, just really school experience. But I had shorthand, and in these days, shorthand was used all the time. They didn't use dictaphones, anything like that. If you had shorthand, you could get a job fairly easily. So I started to work in the courier. And I worked in a department called the Editorial Typists. And that was where there was 13 of us, unlucky for some, but there was 13 of us in the pool. And we all worked for the editors, the various editors of the children's and adult magazines, the children's comics. I worked for the editor of the Bunty and the editor of the Beano. And we would just type up all the script that went into the comics before it went up for printing up the stairs. Came in from the authors who wrote it, and we typed it up, and then it was taken on to another process. And I stayed in the courier office for, well, till I left to have Gillian, so that would have been when I was 21, 22. And that was really the end of my working career. It was short, it was sweet, and it was definitely interesting. And it was varied, and it was mostly good fun. And that was really, apart from all the sort of wee side jobs I did, that was my main employment when I left the school. I always remember too that. I went to work in my first job. I went to work in the beginning with socks. I wasn't allowed to have stockings until I got a wage. So my first week, I went to the office in socks, which caused quite a bit of laughter among the shipping clerks. And it was hard, because everybody else, of course, wore stockings. But my mum said, no, once you're earning a wage, you'll get a pair of stockings. So when I took in my... I think my first wage was something like £2.11. £2.11. And when I took in my first pay packet, I was allowed to go to the draper shop and buy a pair of stockings. But of course, to buy a pair of stockings, you had to also buy a suspender belt. So it wasn't just the stockings, you needed the belt to keep them up. So that was another wee bit of expense. But anyway, that was that. And I was only allowed one pair of stockings a week. So if you laddered your stockings, you were either back to the socks, or you just wore laddered stockings. So I never ever went back to the socks. I was always in laddered stockings till the next week, and I held my breath till the next Friday until we got another pair of stockings. So it's 100 light years away from I think some of the first experiences of employment that some people have, but that was my experience. It never did me any harm, and it it taught me a lot about. There's a lady there called Stella who, she was the sort of senior clerkess, and Stella, I think from day one, did not like me. I think the girl before me had been there for years and years and years, and she'd left to go into another job, and they were quite comfortable with the staff. You know, they knew everybody, everybody knew everybody else. And when I went in, I just, there was this girl particularly, this Stella, you know, she didn't like make life easy for me at all. And, you know, she would be angry about the fires and, you know, if you didn't have the kettle on. And I used to sit beside the switchboard. It was a very old-fashioned switchboard, and my desk was just beside the switchboard, and I was scared of it. You know, every time it clicked, you know, I was terrified. And she'd say to me, for God's sake, answer the phone. And I'd say, well, you know, she says, look, if there's a lever comes down and the lever says number one, press the button that says number one and pick up the phone. So, you know, I would think, okay, that seems okay. That's okay, you know. And I can remember once doing it, and it wasn't number one, but it was, say, number three. So I just pressed the button of number three and said, you know, good morning, Robert Kinnison Sons, can I help you? Thinking as if I could help anybody, I don't know what to do. But I said, good morning, Robert Kinnison Sons, can I help you? And his voice said, good morning, Audrey. This is Mr. Kinnis here. He was just in the office next door. So she hadn't told me about the internal phone. Mm. She's told me about the outside phone and things like that, you know. So she didn't make it easy. But on the other hand, I think it was a great learning experience. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it kind of prepared me in some way for the big bad world of industry, if you like, where you could come across people that weren't entirely helpful or didn't entirely like you. You know, you weren't going to fit into every single situation. And it was a tender age to learn these things, but I think it was a good learning curve.
Can you talk about when you lost your memory?
That was a wee bit scary. I think it was more scary for people round about because I had taken ill. And just thought I was a bit tired, and made an appointment for the doctor, went to the doctor, and from there on in, I've no memory. Now, what I'm going to tell you is what I've been told, because from the point of going to the doctor, I'd evidently gone into the doctor, got into the consulting room, was asked a few questions, and collapsed on the floor. Just like a faint, you know, just at all intents and purposes fainted. So he got me up and got me over onto the bench and pulled in the receptionist, because there were no nurses worked in practices in these days. Now this would be, I was born in 1944 and I think I was probably 24 at that time. Mm-hmm. So that was in 1968. So there's no nurses in practices. Anyway, the receptionist came in and he definitely said to her, did Mrs. Orr come with anybody? Is there anybody in the waiting room? And she said, no. And he says, well, look outside and see if there's a car or, you know, somebody with her. So she looked outside and she says, well, there's a little van sitting there. But she says, I mean, I don't know. He says, well, run out and ask if they came up with Mrs. Orr. And so he says, just a long shot, but, you know, just to see if, so he says, because this woman's quite unwell and it's unlikely that she's come here by herself. So the woman went out and Papa was sitting in the van because he had taken me up. Did you bring Mrs. Orr? Yes. Well, you know, she's not very well. I wonder if you would come in and speak to the doctor. So Papa got a bit of a fright, of course, because he was just sitting waiting for me to come out. So he went in and the doctor said, you know, now Mrs. Orr's quite unwell. We're not quite sure what's going on, but I've taken some blood, we'll have it tested. If you take her home, she'll have to be, you know, put into bed, and I'll come in the evening once I've got the lab results. So I was taken back home, Gran was there looking after Gillian, I was in my bed, and the doctor came in at night, and he said that the lab tests were not showing anything, but I was making no improvement. Evidently had no idea really where I was or what was going on round about me, so they put me into King's Cross, which is in these days was infectious diseases place. You know, if you've picked up something, say you've been abroad, whatever, you went in there, if you had something that they couldn't figure out what it was. So I was put in there and I was given all manner of tests in there for a few days, and they decided that it was nothing sort of as infectious as such, but something was going on neurologically, there was something going on. So they put me over to the neurosurgery ward in the Royal Infirmary, and there I stayed for several weeks, and I was given some tests that were evidently not very pleasant, but the nicest thing is I kind of remember them, but some of the tests were evidently quite unpleasant. And they discovered after certainly a number of days that I had a thing called encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain. And the part that the inflammation had affected was my memory. And I had a bad enough memory to begin with, to tell you the truth. So that was really bad news. The only way to treat this was with strong antibiotics. But when I can remember, I think, and you see, it's difficult for me to remember, to know what I remember and what I've been told. But I think I can remember coming round in the ward, you know, being for the first time quite compos mentis because I was sedated a lot. And there was this little girl in the bed next to me, and she had a kind of sort of cage-looking thing on her head. She'd obviously been in a road accident, I would think, and she had some sort of metalwork around her head. And I can remember her saying, "Mrs. Orr's awake now, nurse." And she'd maybe been asked to let them know when I wakened up. So within no time, the two neurosurgeons were at the desk, a Mr. Block and a Mr. Jameson were both at the bed. And the funny thing was, they were treating me like a little girl. They were saying things like, "And what's your name? And where do you live?" And then the conversation got on, "And how old are you? And you have a little girl, don't you? And what's her name?" Now, some of the questions I couldn't answer at all. But what they noticed was there was something wrong with my speech. My speech was very slurred and very hesitant, you know, almost, yeah, just hesitant and very slurred. So that had to be put right. I was, within the next day or two, I was got out of the bed. I was taken out of the bed for walking, and my balance was not good as well. So it turned out I was to have speech therapy and physiotherapy to put these two things right. So I had that done over a series of I don't know quite how long I was in the hospital, but in all I was probably in about a month between going into King's Cross and then. And so between the physiotherapy, the speech therapy, strong antibiotics, I was allowed home after about a month. But I had all manner of restrictions put on me. I wasn't allowed to drive. I wasn't allowed to look after Gillian on my own, because I think what was happening in the hospital was I was having fits. I was taking fits. So they weren't quite sure if the fits would happen again. So therefore, you know, it wasn't a good idea to be just in charge of Gillian by myself. So stayed at Gran's for a couple of weeks, and then I started to get really quite well. And of course wanted home. And that was when I started to go on the homeopathic medication, because Papa wasn't happy about the strong drugs I was taking. I was having to take these strong drugs, and I went on the homeopathic medication. And when I went back from an outpatient appointment at the hospital, saw one of the surgeons, Mr. Jameson, he was amazed. He was totally amazed that I had made such a good recovery, because evidently this encephalitis it's not likely to end your life, but it can end your active life. You know, it could interfere with your quality of life, and It didn't interfere with my quality of life after a while, but that was having got the strong drugs out of my system, only to replace them with homeopathic medication. And now I didn't own up to the fact that I was not taking the drugs, because they just said, "You're still taking your medication?" And I just said, "Yes." "Well, you're doing remarkably well," says they. And I admit, this is one thing I do remember. The room was full of students, you know, obviously medical students, when he was interviewing me. And he said to one to the students, "Anybody got any questions to ask Mrs. Orr?" And this young student said to me, "Do you manage to read, Mrs. Orr?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "What do you read?" And I said, "Well, I read the papers." And he said, "Do you?" And I said, he says, "Tell me what's in the papers just now. What's happening, you know, what's sort of in the headlines just now?" And I said, "Martin Luther King's been assassinated." So that kind of puts a date on it, doesn't it? And he just looked at me and he said, "Hmm." So I think they were testing me, you see, to see if I, in fact, did read the papers. And I did, because I was so sad about that. You know, that was a tragedy, a complete tragedy. So I remembered that. So I think that gave me a lot of brownie points. And I said, "Could I get to drive now? Can I get my licence back?" Because they took my licence, wasn't allowed to drive. And Mr. Jameson it was, and he said, no. He said, "I think we'll give you another 6 months before we're comfortable with the driving." So I went back in 6 months, and I was almost fully restored. I think I was fully restored to you know, normal health again. And then I got my licence back. And he said to me, "Well, there's nothing we can do, Mrs. Orr. We just need to discharge you." He said, "Normally people like you are coming back here for years and years." And he said, "But, you know, you seem to have made such a good recovery." He said, "I think you've had youth on your side. You know, you're young and you're normally healthy. So you've picked up this infection, and okay, it's you know, it's laid you low, but your actual recovery period has been very good." But I still never mentioned the homeopathic medicine. I just kept taking it, and I still never mentioned that. So that was quite a... But there's a period in my life that I actually simply can't remember, and some of it is before the incident with the doctor, you know, because your dad used to say to me, "Oh, remember... we went," or "remember," but if it was round about that period, it was a complete blank to me. And it's the funniest thing for somebody to say that you were there and you took part in a particular occasion or an incident, and it's a complete blackout for you. You just don't remember it. So they said that there's parts of the memory bank that were damaged and would never come back, but that doesn't matter. That's okay. I just felt... lucky to be restored to good health, you know.